He was almost to the trees when he looked at the plane on the left of him and saw two more tornadoes touch down, trapping him in a triangle of howling death. The hail stopped as if someone had thrown a switch, and the rising, screaming wind pushed so hard against his chest, he thought it'd pluck him from his horse. Branches whipped Luke's body as the horse made the thicket and plunged in. He put an arm up to protect his face and hauled back on the reins with his other. Swinging out of his saddle, he tried to find the sod house. If it hadn't been totally destroyed, it most likely offered the best shelter. His hat was ripped from his head, and when he turned to snatch at it, he saw the dark black funnel of the Twister barreling toward him. Turning around, he saw the sod house through the cluster of tree trunks. It was caved in on one side. The door collapsed, leaving only a window. Wind bent the trees double, and he heard them snap like gunshots as they broke in two or were yanked from the earth. Yanking his Winchester from its saddle boot, he let the horse go and ran toward the partially collapsed sod house. These weren't breaking trees and popping branches. This was the sound of battle.
Cheyenne!
The wind pummeled his back, shoving him forward. As he scrambled into the dark hole of the window, it fairly picked him up and tossed him through. He came down in a tumble, the barrel of his Winchester slamming into his mouth. He tasted blood. Scooting back to face the window, he felt around for his rifle. Hard wind pushed in through the window carved out of the sod, throwing dirt like shotgun pellets into his face. Suddenly, a figure blocked out the light from the window.
White man, don't shoot, please!
The figure's momentum sent him crashing into the bounty hunter. Luke fell backward, holding onto his pistol. His head slammed into something hard. A second, and then a third figure dove through the opening. One of the figures lifted off the ground, revealing a feather sticking from his hair.
They're in here!
Luke swung out blindly with the heavy iron in his hand. A body fell into him. Something hard, a shoulder, rammed into his chin, and he saw another figure scramble in through the window. Yet another silhouette appeared in the opening. In the next moment, it was gone, lifted into the maw of the deadly cyclone. The edge of the sod house roof began peeling back like the lid of a can. Light spilled through the cracks. Clots of dirt and splinters of trees knifed through the air. The Indian on top of him twisted. Luke got a grip on his wrist in time to stop the downward thrust of a knife. Luke brought the Remington up, smashing the barrel alongside his attacker's face. The muzzle flash sparked so close to the warrior, Luke smelled burnt flesh, but the gun smoke was sucked away, along with the rest of the sod house roof. Twilight illumination spilled into the ruin. Dust and debris filled the air. Luke squinted, casting about for the other warriors in the house with them. Two painted braves had a boy in his late teens in the corner. One was reaching for a Sharps 1863 carbine. The other had a tomahawk lifted over his head.
No!
The slugs caught the Indian with a tomahawk between his shoulder blades. Blood from the exit wounds sprayed the cowering boy's face. The brave tumbled forward on top of the boy. The third Indian snatched up his rifle and yanked back the hammer on his breech. The gunshot took Luke completely by surprise. He looked around. Another Cheyenne at the window, his face painted yellow and black. They locked eyes for a moment. The warrior snapped the trigger guard lever down on his Lyman Sharp's carbine, ejecting the spent shell. The bullet took the brave in the side of his neck, and blood spurted out, to be immediately dispersed by the wind into a fine mist. Luke turned his head slowly, taking stock of the room. Icy water trailed down his back. But in the next moment, just as suddenly as it had started, the hail stopped. The low, angry clouds still hung in blocky gray fortresses above them, but there was the feeling of peace that followed every bad storm he'd ever been caught in. It didn't matter if it was desert, plains, or mountains. The feeling of the entire natural world seeming to hold its breath, waiting to make sure the storm had truly passed, was universal.
Holy cow, mister! You done killed them all! That was some slick shooting, I tell you what.
Luke edged up to the window, still worried about another dog soldier popping up.
How many of those Cheyenne were after you when the storm hit?
Six, maybe seven.
That it?
My outfit crossed the trace of a larger band, four, maybe five times that number. The ones I ran into at the river might have been scouts.
Figure seven to assume the worst. Got five dead right here. Need to account for the other two.
Mister?
Yeah?
My name is Josh Palmer, sir. Thank you for saving my life.
I'm not sure if it is saved just yet, seeing as how you just said 7 Indians and I only count 5 dead. Call me Luke.
Okay, Luke. I lost my rifle crossing the creek, and I still got the army Colt my daddy gave me.
Keep it close. See if you can find my Winchester in this mess.
I got it. It's right here.
Okay, good. Cover me from the window with my Winchester. Keep back from it a bit, but move back and forth so you get a wide view. I'm going over the top of the roof.
Yes, sir.
Putting his hand against the wall, Luke carefully peeked over the edge of the missing roof. One of the Cheyenne was 12 feet in the air at the top of a sycamore tree. 3 stout branches sheared into stakes by the twister impaled the dog soldier like cavalry sabers. Blood dribbled steadily out of the wounds to drip off the ends of the busted limbs.
Okay, that's 6.
He climbed over the lip, hung by his fingers, then dropped the short distance to the ground outside. Broken branches stuck in the ground like picket fences. The sod roof was nowhere to be seen.
You see anything, Josh?
Nothing.
Hand me the Winchester, kid.
Josh pushed the rifle through the window and Luke took it.
I guess you'd better climb on out.
As Josh clambered out, Luke walked toward the creek, rifle ready but pointed down. The whole area smelled like a freshly plowed field. The ground was so torn up. The earth beneath his feet was damp from melting hail, which still stood in snow-like patches here and there. The place reminded him of a battlefield once the fighting was over and the survivors were left wandering in shock among the dead.
Hoo-wee! How'd he get up there? Well, that's one less red engine for us to have to shoot.
Could still be one more somewhere. You said 7.
I said maybe 7. Truth? Might have been a little scared when I was doing my arithmetic.
Well, I guess I could understand that. What do you mean by your outfit? You get separated from friends?
Yeah. I guess maybe outfit is too strong a word. There's some partners who ride together.
How many partners?
Well, that can kind of depend.
Depend on what?
Oh, different things, I guess.
Well, how many are riding with y'all right now? Josh?
There he lies.
What? I didn't catch that, Josh.
I said 35.
35 men not working for a particular outfit or on a drive was damn near unheard of. Since the last big Texas drive had been almost a decade ago, what seemed more likely was that Luke had somehow found himself in the company of an outlaw separated from his gang. Josh didn't strike him as a cold-blooded owl hoot, but then it didn't take a lot for men to cross the line on the frontier. Sometimes it was nothing more than partnering up for safety while traveling with the wrong element. Either way, it was apparent that Luke was going to guess what Josh's pards were based on the size of their group alone. Only outlaws or posses caused men to ride in groups that large. Things could turn awkward between him and the kid, and more so if the kid's friends turned up looking for him.
That's a pretty sizable collection of pals. I ain't rode with that many pards since the war. I guess you must have a few veterans in your group.
Hell, it's almost all veterans, mister. I got in because my pa served under the colonel during the March to the Sea.
Sherman's March. Union veterans, then. I never got that far east. I spent my time during the war fighting in Kansas and Missouri. First with Marshal Cleveland and later with the Red Legs.
Jayhawkers like Cleveland and the Red Leg Militias had been the pro-Union version of the Missouri-Kansas border ruffians like William Quantrill and Bloody Bill Anderson. Both sides had well-earned reputations for murder and thievery, as well as being deadly hard-riding pistoliers.
Ooh-wee! I heard you Red Legs was some rough old cubs.
We held our own. Of course, all it left me good for was using these pistols and riding hell-bent for leather.
Lucky for me, I guess. Say, you should think about joining up with us. Colonel Goldsmith's always looking for steady gun hands. I reckon there ain't no steadier gun hand than an ex-guerrilla.
Well, I ain't exactly flush, and I ain't exactly looking to become no damn sodbuster.
You're going to fit right in, Luke.
Chapter 5, Kansas. A rough-looking bunch.
The two of them separated and walked up and down the creek bed, looking for their horses. By some miracle of dumb luck, Luke found both animals grazing about a mile and a half beyond the ruined sod house. Both were white-eyed and tense with the stress of the storm. He didn't even attempt to approach Josh's horse, focusing on calming his own mount instead.
Easy, big fella. I was only kidding about how much you'd like being an Indian pony.
After a little while, the horse let him approach and run his hands along him to check for injuries. The animal needed a good brushing, but other than nerves, it seemed fine, thankfully. When he swung up into the saddle and started back toward the ruins, Josh's horse, a bay gelding, didn't seem to want to be separated from the other animal, and followed along easily enough. He found Josh half a mile down the creek in the other direction from the sod house. The kid was no longer alone. His outfit had found him. 35 men ranged along the bank of the stream, watering their horses. As Luke approached, the ragtag bunch watched him with suspicious gazes. Most kept carbines handy over their shoulders, ready to be brought up at a moment's notice. Luke kept his hands visible and approached at a slow amble. Josh stood in front of two men on horseback. One was a burly character with a bear-like build and a wild black beard that nearly reached his belt. The other was older and much leaner, and something about him reminded Luke of a wolf. Even from a distance, Luke could see the scars on the man's face where he'd been burned.
You found my horse!
He was with mine, down the creek a ways.
He looked at the two men and nodded in greeting. The group was a rough-looking bunch. Multiple knives and pistols hung from gun belts. Every man carried a rifle of some sort. Dirty and ill-kept the men might be, but their weapons looked clean and well-maintained. Scars, missing fingers, the occasional eye patch, and plenty of missing teeth. The smell of unwashed men was strong enough to get up and walk around on its own 2 feet. Their horses, like their weapons, looked healthy and well cared for, the saddles well oiled and burnished. He'd seen the same sharp contrast in army units on the frontier. Soldiers were off in the flotsam and jetsam of society, but their lives depended on their horses and guns. As such, soldiers tended to be meticulous in their care, and more lackadaisical of their own. Luke touched the brim of his hat.
Howdy.
This here is Luke, the one I told you about, Colonel. The one that killed them Injuns with the slickest gun handling you ever saw. It was unbelievable, Colonel. He drew on him so quick.
The Scarface man studied him intently as Josh babbled on, describing Luke's prowess in bringing down 5 dog soldiers. The Scarface man chewed on the end of a Lucifer match. It was the brute of a man beside him who spoke first, though.
Quiet, boy. That's true, mister. You killed 5 of those red devils so slick-like.
He wore a black cavalry slouch hat with distinct gold brocade and wide, hand-rolled kettle brim. His body was covered in a worn but well-made duster. He wore a peacemaker on his hip, and there was a gleaming Henry 44 lever-action carbine in his saddle boot.
There's 5 dead in that sod house back yonder. I killed them. I don't know how slick it was, though. It got a little close there at times, if I'm being honest. They came in expecting just to find Josh, and that helped some. They were as surprised as I was.
The man scrutinized him, sizing him up.
Well, we're obliged to you for helping the boy. Josh's pa rode with me in the war. Lost his leg south of Atlanta. I feel mighty responsible for him. I'm Neville Goldsmith, formerly Colonel, Army of Georgia. This is my Sergeant Major, Jeremiah Trask.
Sir, he rode with Marshal Cleveland's boys during the war.
That's so.
Cleveland at the start. They claim those James boys invented bank robbery, but that's a damn lie. We were robbing Missouri banks back in 61.
Didn't his own boys kill Cleveland?
Sure did. 6th Kansas Cavalry caught up with us down around the Meritazine River. Old Marshal wasn't so good at reading maps, it seems. Come to find out, the last two banks we robbed had turned out to have been in Kansas. Those Union boys didn't care for that.
How'd you escape?
I didn't have no truck with killing Union soldiers. I assumed orders was orders when we took them banks. I'll kill a Johnny Reb if he was eating dinner, but I don't want to be shooting boys on my own side just because they were in uniform and I was an irregular. When the 6th Kansas caught up with us, we assumed there was going to be a talking to or a dressing down. At worst, they would escort Captain Cleveland back and maybe break up the group. But the captain was a stubborn man, prone to outbursts. He also liked to punctuate points by drawing his pistols and waving them around. They shot him down. So there I was, pretty young. And the next thing I know, Cleveland's dead, and they're riding us back to what I figured to be a hang rope.
So how'd you escape the noose?
By the skin of my teeth, if I'm being honest. They needed men in the border region. The West wasn't a prime concern for the generals back east. We may have been wild as red savages back then, but we could ride and shoot, and we'd killed more separatists than any regular unit at that point. Long story short, I ended up riding with Jennison. I was a red blade for the rest of the war.
Well, I guess we need to say thank you for keeping our young Josh here alive. And any man who can do for 5 hostile Redskins in one fight is someone I'd be happy to have at my side. Mister, I didn't get your name.
Miller. Luke Miller.
All right, Mr. Miller. Why don't you come on back to our camp? I believe some of the boys have enough good whiskey to knock the taste of that twister out of our mouths.
Well, yes, sir. I do appreciate the invite.
By pure chance, Luke had found the very outlaws he was looking for. But now, he was surrounded by them, and his only chance of survival was to gain their trust and acceptance. Providence had delivered them to him, though, and he wasn't going to waste the opportunity. Also, he didn't really have any other choice. They were holed up in an old buffalo wallow, deep enough to provide some cover for the light of their campfire. On the plains at night, you could see light for almost unbelievable distances. Campfires could look as bright as stars scattered across the grassland. The outfit seemed well supplied. In addition to extra horses for each man, they had a small mule train. Such organization in an outlaw gang was surprising. Usually they kept a hideout somewhere, or scattered once a job was done, not regrouping until it was time to pull another robbery. This group seemed to set up like a military force on an extended expedition. They even referred to themselves as a unit rather than a gang. Considering that they were capable of killing him where he sat, Goldsmith's riders were friendly enough. Still, he was a stranger and untested.
Thank you.
He accepted a jug of corn whiskey and took a slug. He had to keep his wits about him, but he also had to win the men's trust. So he drank. Josh sat beside him at the fire in the outlaws' camp, and he began to suspect that the kid felt out of place in this gang of hard cases. He wore a lost, lonely expression as he stared into the flickering flames.
You don't mind me asking, how exactly did you end up with these boys? Seems to me the greater part of them rode under Goldsmith in the war. Even those that didn't are veterans.
Josh stared into the fire. He sat quietly for so long that Luke thought he wasn't going to answer the question.
My pa, I guess. Like I told you, he rode with Colonel Goldsmith when they marched through Georgia under Sherman. My pa lost his legs at Bentonville. The damn war was pretty near done at that point, and he got shot through one leg and into the other. He said them army docs was always quick on the saw.
Your pa gone now?
No, he's still alive, back home in Indiana. Oh, sometimes I think he does wish he was dead. Mama swears he ain't known a happy day since March of 65.
So he sent you to ride with Goldsmith?
Colonel Goldsmith.
So he sent you to ride with Colonel Goldsmith?
No, it was my idea, I guess, more or less. This country turned its back on veterans. They were loyal, and then the country wasn't loyal to them. You imagine a man who fought from Bull Run to Appomattox reduced to begging for the rest of his life? It ain't right.
Luke kept silent. A lot of sour plants of hate and rage had grown from seeds of truth.
One day, a member of his old unit came back asking to spend the night and told him he was going west to join up with the colonel again. When he heard Colonel Goldsmith and Sergeant Major Trask were set to ride again like they'd done in Georgia and the Carolinas, he was pretty damn happy for once. "You watch, son," he said. "The colonel's going to bring hell to all the ex-Confederates, draft dodgers, and those that abandoned us after the war who thought they could run away to the frontier. I decided I couldn't pass up the chance. So when my dad's army friend started out in the morning, I made up my mind and went with him. I figured it was a son's duty to avenge his father."
Your daddy's friend still here?
No, he was killed up in Dakota Territory. But I'd already ridden on 3 raids by then.
Luke nodded. He felt sad for the kid. His father's poison had sent his son down the Owl Hoot path. That trail ended in gunfire or the rope. Josh's father thought he'd just lost his legs in the war. In the end, it would likely cost him his son as well. Luke brooded. Maybe there was a way he could convince Josh to leave the gang. He'd like to see the kid spared the hellfire that was coming for these men. But the boy was a man. He'd made a man's decision, and he rode with hard cases. It might already be too late. He said goodnight and settled down in his bedroll. Exhausted by the day's events, sleep came easily enough to him, but his dreams were troubled.
Morning, Sergeant Major.
Colonel's got a little mission for us. Finish up and let's go see the main.
Yes, Sergeant Major.
Sounds good.
The Sergeant Major and I have been talking. We need to perform some reconnaissance and consider our options before we act.
Makes sense. What'd you have in mind?
You and young Josh here are going to accompany the Sergeant Major into a nearby settlement called Hatchet Creek. We need to get an idea of how many deputies the sheriff has, how many men are likely to take up arms in an emergency, where the likeliest places to hit for cash money are.
Yes, sir.
We're gonna hit Hatchet Creek next, then?
We ain't necessarily doing a damn thing, Red Leg. We don't know how you handle yourself, or even if you are who you say you are.
Well, I can handle myself just fine. I'm ready to prove that any time with anyone.
At ease.
Yes, sir, Colonel.
Yes, sir.
This is a learning experience for young Josh. A chance for him to show he can be trusted with jobs harder than watching the horses when the rest of the men go to work.
Yes, sir, Colonel. I won't let you down.
I know, son. You understand we can't just take Josh's word on you. Most of these boys have been together since the war started. The ones who didn't ride with me for Sherman have been with us a good spell. We know they're solid. If we're going to trust you, Miller, we need to see how you handle yourself.
That makes sense. I appreciate the opportunity to prove myself.
One of the fastest ways to earn our trust is showing you're able to follow the chain of command. That means listening to the Sergeant Major.
I get that. I know how to ride with an outfit.
And that's just what we are, Luke. We're an outfit. A unit. Just like the Red Legs. We're taking our fight to ex-rebels who think their crimes have been forgiven. We're taking our fight to those who turned their backs on us after the war.
That sounds all right by me, Colonel.
Good. Then get to it.
Chapter 6, Hatchet Creek. This place is hopping.
As Luke approached the town with Josh and Trask, he realized that he had been through the settlement a couple of years earlier. Although, as far as he remembered, he had never heard the name of the place. It had been a lot smaller then, too, barely more than a wide place in the trail. As that crotchety old newspaper man back in Carlton had told him, Hatchet Creek had grown a lot since the railroad reached Ellsworth, not far away. Now it was starting to look like a real town. Luke hadn't interacted with a lot of the folks here, just picked up a few supplies at a trading post and moved on. Nobody in Hatchet Creek had any reason to remember him or know that he was a bounty hunter. But after so many years of roaming around the frontier, it was impossible to guarantee he wouldn't run into somebody who would recognize him. In particular, the sheriff. The town was booming. A large company of freight haulers had arrived with supplies. The streets were crowded with people shopping, and the platoons of bullwhackers and mule skinners looking to blow off steam after an arduous and dangerous trip. Mule skinners were freighters who drove wagons pulled by mules. Bullwhackers were those freighters who used teams of oxen. Neither group of laborers was considered the cream of society. Luke, Trask, and Josh were able to corral their mounts without incident. They walked slowly up and down the main street, Luke sweating them running into the sheriff the whole time. That didn't happen, however, and after thoroughly walking the town, Trask seemed satisfied for the moment. The bank was the primary target, but Trask also picked out the largest general store. It might have a safe so that the owner could lock away a day's receipts and not take them to the bank until the next morning. They went inside to have a look around.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
You got any money on you, kid?
Good afternoon.
Yeah? Why?
What could I offer you today?
Go buy some candy.
I'm not some kid.
I don't want that clerk getting suspicious of us.
Camp supplies, trail provisions, I got some fresh jerky.
Oh, I...
Just do what I told you.
How about some...
Got any candy?
Josh wandered over to a glass-fronted case that held various types of candy. Luke and Trask ambled along the rear counter.
Well, yes we do, young man. All kinds and flavors. I'll be right with you, gentlemen. Now, what can I get you?
Ooh, boy. Can I have one of those, sir? Oh, and some of that licorice, too?
Excellent choices. Now, we have black or red licorice.
Black and red? Ooh, boy.
Yep, there's a safe back there, all right.
I prefer the red myself. Never much had the taste for the black kind, but each to his own, I always say.
I see it. A square drop with one of those newfangled combination locks.
Okay, now here you go. Is there anything else I can tempt you with today? Perhaps some rock candy?
Yes, sir.
Let's go. come along, son.
10 cents, please.
Here you go. Thank you, sir.
You, get what you wanted.
Oh, yeah. How about you?
Sure.
You want some of this licorice, Sergeant?
No, damn it. Hey, don't call me Sergeant.
Oh, sorry. I forgot.
Let's finish taking our look around.
The next obvious targets were the saloons and brothels. The establishments were booming and likely had considerable amounts of money stashed away. But being able to loot them depended heavily on how many customers and employees left to fight the fire Luke knew the gang would set as a distraction.
Maybe we should pick out one or maybe at most two places with setups that look particularly lucrative. One of us can check as we ride in, and if there aren't too many people hanging around, we take them while the rest go for the bank.
I suppose that could work. We'll have to take closer looks at them before we make up our minds, though. Make sure we got our eyes on the best place.
If we're gonna do that, we'll need to blend in. We don't want to stand out. We'll need to drink, maybe buy a girl, stuff like that.
Uh-huh. Beer only. And keep your eyes peeled for where they keep the safe.
That's real funny. You get it?
Above the batwing doors hung a painted sign with a surprisingly good depiction of a rooster riding the back of a cat. No words were written on it.
Yeah, kid, I'm pretty sure everybody gets it.
Even though it was a weekday, the place was busy. In fact, it seemed rowdy to a point just short of a riot. Rough-looking men in dirty clothes filled the room. The bullwhackers, who had brought the freight wagons into town, lined the long bar where saloon girls goaded them into buying drinks. Some took up the tables as well, some of them playing cards. A roulette wheel and two faro tables sat on one side of the room. Those were filled with more shouting, laughing men than the bar. More saloon girls mixed with the gamblers, wearing low-cut and corseted dresses, egging the men on to reckless bets and even more shots of whiskey. A man banged out songs on an old piano, stopping every now and then to take swigs from a beer and count his tips. Sawdust was scattered on the floor. Tobacco smoke hung in a fog just over the heads of the customers. Upstairs, an endless parade of men entered and left the rooms where scantily clad women waited in their doorways.
Beer only.
Yes, sir.
Easing their way through the crowd, they managed to reach the bar. The bartender was an abnormally tall and pale man with oiled down hair and a handlebar mustache waxed to points sharp as arrowheads. He wore a red and white striped button-up shirt under a tan apron.
What are you gents drinking?
Beer?
Beer.
Beer. Coming up.
This place is hopping!
Luke smiled. The kid's good nature was infectious. Not all of his basic wonder at the world had been knocked out of him yet. In Luke's experience, it was an exceedingly rare commodity.
You ain't here on no damn vacation.
Oh, we got time to see a girl, don't we? I mean, we're already in town.
I'd let the kid have some fun. I'll stick with him and sort of hurry him along. Give you a chance to do some business without having the nursemaid him.
I guess that makes sense. I wanted to double check some anyhow.
Probably wise. We need to do as thorough a job as we can.
I think I might just get my shirts laundered.
Trask jabbed him in the chest with a blunt finger.
You're responsible for the kid. Make sure he don't go shooting his damn full mouth off.
Not a problem.
Trouble hit almost as soon as Trask made it out the door. Saloon girls had a very specific job. They flirted with customers and encouraged the men to purchase drinks for them. Drinks for the girls were usually a little bit more expensive. Sometimes they were prostitutes hustling for business as well, but frequently they were not.
Hi there, cowboy.
One of them approached Josh. She was a pretty little thing, no more than 19 at the most, with an elfin face and a curvy but compact figure. Her hair was the color of summer wheat, and her eyes a startling shade of cornflower blue. She draped her body against Josh's.
My name's Sarah. Buy a girl a drink?
I...
The best way to learn was by doing, so Luke didn't try to save the kid. He leaned over to Josh.
We're just drinking beer.
Why, shoot, that's fine by me. Well, I get plumb crazy when I drink too much. There's no telling what I might do if I get drunk.
She ran a finger up and down Josh's arm.
Whiskey for the lady. I'll stick to beer.
Come here, gal.
A giant bullwhacker stood before them. At 6.5 feet tall, he towered over Josh, who was average height. His frame was heavy and his hands large as dinner plates.
Pretty little thing like you needs to be with a real man, not some damn pup.
Luke noticed a .44 Henry revolver pushed behind his broad leather belt, as well as an Arkansas toothpick with a 14-inch double-edged blade. He was loud, clearly drunk, and just as clearly used to getting what he wanted by virtue of his massive size. With one grubby paw, he snatched up the girl's arm, yanking her to him. The saloon girl was like a child compared to him. She bounced into his body as he pressed her close, leering at Josh over her head.
You like that, little girl? Big Edgar knows what the pretty girls like.
Let me go, you damn jackass!
Josh spun. His hand went for the army colt at his waist. Luke stopped him.
Easy. The trail boss ain't gonna appreciate you getting pinched into the hoosegow right before it's time to go to work.
The kid relaxed, but Big Edgar had seen Josh's initial move and responded. He threw the girl to one side and drew his .44. Luke stepped around Josh, shoving the barrel of his Remington up under the man's chin. The bullwhacker froze.
Easy. We don't want this getting out of hand.
That's right, gentlemen. We don't want this getting out of hand.
The bartender had a sawed-off greener side-by-side 10-gauge. If he triggered the hand cannon from this range, the shot would take off both men's heads.
Willie! It was that stinking bullwhacker who started it.
You drink with the customers, Sarah, whoever the customer is. You don't like that? I figure you can work someplace else.
Yeah, I was just offering to buy the little miss a drink is all.
Both of you holster them big irons. Now.
Carefully, glaring at each other, the men put their revolvers away.
I'm drinking with the girl.
She's drinking with me, boy.
It's a free country. The lady can choose who she drinks with.
That's right.
The hell she can. My money spends as well as this here boy's. Willie, you know I bring plenty of money in here every month when I bring my boys to town. I'm a good regular customer, not some no-account drifter.
She's drinking with me.
Bartender, Willie, is it? Now, I don't see how, Willie, you explaining a bunch of dead men in your place to the sheriff, no matter who or why they're dead, is gonna help you to do business. Well, he's liable to shut the place down.
After a long, tense moment, a look of consternation appeared on Willie the bartender's face. He lowered the greener and looked around. Men waiting for a gun duel weren't busily spending money on cards or liquor or women.
If you boys want to fight over her, I won't let her go with either one of you. I'll send my boy to fetch the sheriff and have both of you thrown behind bars.
This ain't settled.
Then you can settle it with cards.
Yeah, okay.
Play a hand of faro for her. Winner take all. The loser goes someplace else to drink.
Fine by me. Let's do it.
What the hell is happening here?
Faro was a simple game. It was that very simplicity that contributed to its popularity. It was exceedingly hard to cheat, and it could be played almost blind drunk. Luke had heard it likened to playing roulette with cards. Going from ace through the numbered cards to the king, 13 cards of one suit, almost always spades, were laid down in two rows of six, with the seven of spades put off just to the immediate side. This was the game board. Players picked the card with the face value, ace through king, they thought would win, and put their money or chips on that card. The dealer took a regular 52-card deck and turned over the first card, showed the players, then discarded that draw. The game started. The dealer flipped over two cards. The first card was the losing draw. Anyone except the banker with bets on that card lost. The second card was the winning draw. Any player with bets on a card of the same face value doubled his money. The rest drew even. Once the two drawn cards were put in a bone pile to one side, players were free to change their bets to different cards or double down on the choice they'd already made. Discarded cards were left face up and clearly visible. The dealer then drew two more cards. If both drawn cards were the same face value, then the dealer took half of the money on that card. The house held the advantage, but there was still a reasonable chance of winning.
Why don't you get us some drinks, darling?
Sure thing, sweetie. Be right back.
Luke, I hate to ask, but you couldn't see your way to maybe lending me a little money, could you? Please? It ain't right that such a nice girl should have to go with a no-account bit of trash like him.
Fine.
Thanks, Bard.
Here's a 20. Buy chips from the dealer with this.
You ready to lose your money, boy? Once I'm done cleaning you out, I'll show that little piece of fluff how a man does it.
Beat this buffalo patty until he cries, Josh.
You calling someone a buffalo patty?
Well, I guess if I'm talking to you, you'll know it.
Are we gonna play or not?
Ready when you are, sir.
We're playing until one of us is bust.
The hell we are. One hand, winner take all.
All right. But you gotta match my bet.
I can't cover that all at once.
This isn't what we agreed on, Willie.
The bartender had locked his gaze on the bag of silver the bullwhacker had put on the faro table. The more these two drunk fools bet, the more the house stood to gain.
I reckon I think it's fair to let things play out.
All right.
Reaching into his shirt pocket, he pulled out a roll of $20 and $50 government notes. He figured the amount of his bounty money roughly covered what the bullwhacker had shown in silver.
Beat him, Josh.
Suddenly, a slinky-looking saloon girl in a red satin corset petticoat and knee-high lace-up-the-front high-heeled boots sidled up to him.
Buy a girl a drink? Gambling is thirsty work.
She smelled like lavender and had huge brown eyes. Hugging his arm, she gently pressed the swell of her generous and very much on display bosom against him. He was on the verge of sending her politely away when Josh, with Sarah laughing in delight, shoved the entire kitty Luke had just staked him across the table to the dealer, who began counting out chips.
I must need my head examined.
What's that, sweetie?
I said, get us a bottle and hope for both our sakes the kid wins.
Right away, big fella.
She gave his thigh a squeeze, just as the dealer declared.
All bets final. Satisfied?
Get on with it already. Somebody bring me a whiskey.
This kind of contest constituted first-class entertainment around these parts. The girl reappeared at Luke's arm with the bottle. She handed him a shot glass.
Call me Jenny.
Her breath blew warm across his ear. Once again, he felt the press of her breasts, as subtle as a sledgehammer.
Here's to you, Jenny.
But a sledgehammer doesn't need to be subtle to knock you on your butt. The whiskey spread a warm, relaxed feeling through his body.
Place your bets.
Josh and Edgar began putting chips on cards. Edgar threw back two more whiskey shots, one after the other, smooth as a piston on a steam engine. By Luke's reckoning, he'd already been well lubricated before this whole situation had unfolded. He looked bleary-eyed and unsteady on his feet. His betting system seemed to be to spread as many bets as possible across multiple cards. Josh, seeing what he was doing, was forced to place an equal amount of bets in order not to fall behind. At this rate, they'd burn through their stakes quickly.
No more bets.
The dealer turned over the top card, a three of hearts. He moved the card to the side and started his bone pile. He turned over the first card, the losing card. King of diamonds.
Son of a...
Edgar had placed a stack of chips on the king. The dealer then turned over the winning card. King of spades.
Dang it.
Don't worry. I'll bring you good luck.
The dealer put the cards face up in the bone pile. The two men placed their bets while the crowd shouted encouragement. Jenny leaned her soft body against Luke, slipping an arm around his waist. She smelled good. She felt good. The dealer turned over the losing card.
Five of clubs.
God damn it!
The dealer turned over the winning card. A king of clubs.
Woohoo! Holy cow! Yeah!
The game went back and forth for several hands as the deck whittled down. Josh won a huge round when the dealer turned up the king of hearts as the winning card.
This is all a bunch of crap!
Luke wasn't even sure what that statement meant, but what he was sure of was that Edgar had just put several chips down on the king, despite there being four kings in the bone pile. Sarah leaned in close and grabbed his thigh, whispering into the kid's ear.
Dead bet?
Dead bet!
What are you talking about? I didn't put down no dead bet.
Dead bet on king.
Grinning, Josh scooped the chips off the king card.
Jenny, my dear, I do believe I'll have another shot now.
The game went up and down as the deck of cards whittled to the end. Edgar placed no more dead bets, and the two men held more or less even, with neither holding a clear advantage, though Josh overall won more rounds. Soon the number of dead cards in the bone pile grew, forcing the gamblers to more narrowly place their bets as they ran out of choices.
Last three cards.
I'm damn well done with this nonsense. I got better things to do than teaching some damn puppy how to play cards all night.
You cashing it in?
Not by a damn sight. The day Edgar cashes out of the contest with some wit behind the ears little puppy boy is the day he screws an ox.
Well, there has been talk.
You and I are not finished. Not by a sight. Let's finish this. Last three cards. Winner take all.
Fine. But he gets to choose first. Sorry, honey. I got a little carried away.
That's all right, darling. I ain't backing down from this son of a gun.
In Faro, when a deck was run down to the last three cards before a reshuffle of the bone pile into a new deck, a side bet was possible. The players could bet on the order in which each of the last three cards would be turned over and put into play.
I'm in. You pick, darling. You're my good luck.
She kissed him hard on the mouth as the crowd cheered and Edgar fumed.
10, 8, 3.
Bet nay.
It was done.